Okay, so tonight, as a continuation of our foundational Buddhist teachings class, and tonight I'm sharing one of my, not for the first time in at Brightway, but it's been a while, one of my favorite teachings, the Buddhist teaching of the six realms. And this is a little booklet I wrote about it, and there are copies available out in the hall for $5 a piece if you're interested. So this is in a sense, this is a teaching. It's not exactly like something that the Buddha taught per se. It's based on a cosmology, a sense of the way the universe is structured that Buddhism kind of inherited. It was just a typical of many Indian religions at the time that Buddhism arose, saw the universe more or less in this way. But this is kind of the particular Buddhist take on this whole idea of rebirth. And so I'm going to hand out, pass those around, and will you come grab these and pass them that way? So this is a, oh, will you give me one? There's plenty of them if you just want to hand one back. So this is an image of the six realms. So it's a big circle, and it's being held by a ferocious-looking monster. Whose name is Yama. He is the Lord of Death, and he's actually also pictured in the six realms in the bottom realm, the hell realm. He is so in that bottom little segment there, that the hell realm, the idea is that beings were reborn life after life, and there's a little circle in the middle. You can see people like going around and around. And the idea is that when we die, we go visit the hell realm and we come face to face with Yama, and he holds up a mirror. So in a way, this whole picture with these six realms is a mirror of what's going on in the world. And so he holds up a mirror to us, and we, like the good and bad deeds of our life, is our life is reflected. And based on that, we end up, we get back up, go back up that ladder and go around until, we get off on the appropriate realm for our next life, based on the deeds of the previous life. So I'm just a basically, I'm going to go over each realm, like the meaning, and also in particular, we wouldn't be focusing on this if this was about believing in rebirth or transmigration or different realms or anything like that. The reason that we focus on it is because it is a very useful, I mean, for many of us really like it, really useful metaphor for our states of mind, our states of being that we either experience over the course of a day or over a life, and states that we see other people being kind of caught in. And in each of these realms, there is a Buddha that offers a way out of that realm. So in the Buddhist cosmology, and so at the very top there's heaven, the very bottom there's hell, but there's obviously four additional realms as well. And this whole idea, it's also this is also called the wheel of samsara, because the idea is because of rebirth, we go around and around. So you don't end up in one realm forever, like in the Christian version, like you just, except for maybe purgatory, heaven and hell are kind of permanent. This is it's never permanent. And you go around and around. So in that sense, heaven is not a goal. I mean, it's not a bad outcome, you know, as things go, as you're cycling around and around. But even your time in heaven will run out. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's see. So another aspect of the cosmology, and you can see we have we actually have a big book of tonkas, of Tibetan tonkas, and one of them is an elaborate picture of this. And it gets very detailed. Like, this is a pretty simple line drawing, and it gets very detailed with all the beings in the realms. And so one of the things is, at the very center, you have the pig, the rooster, and the snake, and they stand for greed, hate, and delusion. So those are the forces that keep the whole thing turning around and around and around. Then you have the people going around to their different realms. You have the six realms themselves. And then around the outer circle, edge of the circle, are a pictorial representation of the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, which is the Buddhist, you know, view of like how causation happens, how ignorance leads to grasping, leads to rebirth, leads to da 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 da. So how does the whole thing keep going? And in terms of, you know, like this whole presentation of the idea of rebirth and transmigration and stuff, we'll speak of it very freely, but like I said, it's, we think of it as a metaphor. There's other Buddhists who do not view this as a metaphor. They view this very literally. But I don't think that is at all necessary to Buddhism, certainly not my inclination. But there's a power to some of these kind of mythological images, if you will, that there is a truth conveyed by them that doesn't mean the myth has to be literally true, and yet there is a truth about the human experience that is conveyed through this. So that it's almost like, in some senses, I think of these things as sometimes it's as if it's true. In a strange way, it's as if this is true. I guess I'll just start in on the realms, unless anybody has a question about the kind of cosmology as a whole. Yeah.
So, thinking of the tonkas, were they intended as teaching aids?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Back in Nepal, Tibet is where I ran across them at the first time. And weren't the societies pretty much illiterate at that time? Only the priests and the monks could read?
Right? Yeah, I'm not sure myself, but that certainly sounds likely. And, you know, I mean, so it was teaching aids, but also, you know, same as most religious imagery, you know, to kind of impress or to, you know, bring about devotion or whatever.
So when you're saying and calling them, you know, allegories or examples, these really are just to spark the understanding, not to be representing them as a reality, a picture of reality.
Yeah, although, I mean, plenty of Buddhists through time have really believed that, you know. So there's been plenty of people that, if you will, have been and are fundamentalist Buddhists, you know, that, like, okay, know that there really are realms and that we really are reborn. And, you know, just to be, you know, honest and fair when we're talking about foundational Buddhist teachings. But I think most people are probably going to fall on some spectrum in between of thinking of things as just entirely metaphorical and being a little more agnostic about it. Like, So in my little booklet here, I go through each realm and talk about the stuff that I'm going to talk about tonight. Some of the iconography and mythology and imagery associated with each realm, the story of, like, how do you get reborn in that realm and how do you end up getting out of that realm and things like that. But also in particular, each realm section has a practicing with this realm. So when we find ourselves in that state, what can we do about it? So I'm going to start off with the heaven realm. And particularly the heaven realm and the hell realm in Buddhist literature, they are described with great detail. So apparently, you know, it's not just Christians that got really into imagining what heaven and hell might look like. All the different levels, all the different implications and people who were there and all that. So the heaven realm, the denizens of the heaven realm are called devas, which is kind of like gods, but gods with a lowercase d. They're not omniscient gods. And eventually, like I said, their time in heaven will run out and they will fall out of heaven. So again, I'm presenting this stuff kind of as if it's true, because the iconography and mythology seems a little more lively. But devas are very powerful and they live for countless ages. I think they're also like really large. They have perfect health, happiness, wealth, good fortune, all of their lives. Any needs they may have are met by a wish-fulfilling tree. So you can see the wish-fulfilling tree in there. And it fruits in the heaven realm. And it's based in the Asura realm, the realm of the jealous demigods, which I will get to next. Because they are constantly envious of the heaven realm, which is why one of them is trying to chop down the wish-fulfilling tree. But the devas, there they are enjoying their, you know, music and leisure and everything. The deva's body shines with a brilliant light that is visible for miles. And he or she does not sweat or feel any discomfort. Their clothes and flower garlands never fade or get dirty, no matter how long they are worn. And they can only be killed by decapitation. Any other wounds they receive can be healed by divine ambrosia. And the lowest, there's different levels of heaven. So at the very lowest level is the desire realm, with great pleasure and delight. And I think this is, I always love this part. Birth is spontaneous. The children appear at age 5. And parenting is communal. So they just appear, and then the devas are like, oh, you know, take care of them. And the higher levels of the desire realm, devas become more and more free of concern about mundane affairs. So there's the heaven without fighting, the joyful heaven. Heaven's where your very wish makes whatever you need appear. Then there's an even higher level where other people anticipate your needs and make things appear before you even have to think about them. Interestingly, the lowest heaven realm, the one that stays most in touch with the other realms, they're the ones responsible for fighting the Asuras and keeping them from chopping down the wish-fulfilling tree. But they have to, they're naturally have no aggression. So they have to there's this forest they go into to make themselves aggressive so they can fight the Asuras. Like, you know, so that it's their job, their burden is they have to fight off the Asuras. But, and the higher realms, the devas don't have to worry about that. So even beyond the desire realm, in the form, there's form and formless realms. And these are achieved by high levels of spiritual discipline and a lack of attachment to material existence. So in a way, the higher realms of heaven are like higher, more refined, rarefied spiritual realms. They have ethereal bodies not subject to physical or mental suffering. At the highest realms, these devas are spared anticipating their own deaths. But But from there on down, the devas, that they that's the thing, is they anticipate. At first, they're kind of self-aware when they first appear in heaven, like, probably this is great. But then they just, it's kind of like, they just, there's no thought of enlightenment. They're just enjoying themselves. They're just, they're kind of like a state of spiritual slumber until the time that they're going to, that their end, they're going to have to leave heaven is starting to approach. They start to sweat and stink, and their clothes start to get dirty. And like, so they kind of, you know, like they see it coming. And the description of this is like, it's more torment than hell. Is that they're in this heaven realm, but they see it ending. You are reborn in the heaven realm because of meritorious and charitable deeds, or even spiritual practice that doesn't quite reach that state of liberation, which I will get to when we get to the human realm, because it's considered the human realm is the ideal realm for awakening in the Buddhist sense. And the ideal, in this cosmology anyway, Buddhist awakening is stepping off this wheel entirely. It's getting no longer sucked into this pattern of rebirth, but getting free from it. So the heaven realm is not a great place to practice because, yeah, you're not very motivated. So you're reborn there when, you know, you've not done direct harm to other beings. But inevitably it will run out. And so the Buddha of that realm, I mean, it's not really, doesn't really make sense for the Buddha to be trying to help you escape the heaven realm or whatever, but the Buddha's kind of just playing a musical instrument and just kind of waiting because, you know, there's not too much else that that Buddha can do, but eventually the time in heaven will come to an end and then it'll be time to start doing some spiritual practice again. So then to the right, we have the Asuras. So they fall out of the heaven realm, experience a lot of bitterness and envy.
So you always go from the heaven realm to the...
You don't, but yeah, so you could plummet, you know, and kind of whatever direction, you know, you can go around and around. But it is kind of thought that so those three higher realms are considered somewhat fortunate rebirths, and the three lower ones are unfortunate. The human realm is the one to the left of heaven. So chances are you're going to kind of end up in an adjacent realm. So the Asuras, they have fallen out of heaven, and unlike many of the beings in this picture who just don't remember what came before, the Asuras do remember. They remember being devas. And now there's this wish-fulfilling tree that, you know, is flowering up in heaven. But the thing is that the Asura realm really isn't bad. I mean, it's fairly fortunate, fairly comfortable. They have everything that they need, but they're always fixated on what they don't have. And there's a sense of competitiveness and threat, you know, what you have is under threat by somebody else. And they're constantly, they see the world of limited resources, a lot of mistrust. They're constantly waging war against heaven, and they never, ever, ever win. Like, you know, you can only kill a deva by decapitation, and they're like huge. And Indra, the deva, comes after them on an elephant with 33 heads and throws mountains at them, and the Asuras die easily. So, but they just can't help it. They just have to keep on waging war against heaven. So then they fight amongst themselves, even though blessed with pleasures and comforts. And the thing is that you're reborn there after living a fairly good life, but harboring resentment, jealousy, envy, greed. So the Asuras are too busy to engage in spiritual practice. So the Buddha speaks the language of the Asuras in an enlightened way. He carries a sword, symbolizing moral restraint and order. And then I guess just to backtrack to heaven for a second, just to end each of these with a sense of like, how do we practice with these realms when we find ourselves in them? When we find ourselves in a heaven realm, I mean, we may not even notice, right? But to some extent, we can find ourselves realizing that we're not terribly motivated to practice because everything's pretty nice. And what are you going to do about that? Like, you know, wreck your life so it isn't nice? Like, it's a certain point. I mean, we're never actually like fully in the heaven realm like the devas are, but there's, to a certain extent, there's a certain patience we just have to have with ourselves when we recognize that, you know, we're in very fortunate circumstances. And but in a way, to, if our practice at that point can be to remind ourselves that it won't be that way forever, you know, to appreciate it while it lasts, but also not to neglect our spiritual practice or neglect others because things will change. And then in terms of the Asura realm, now in terms of our world, I think we can see whether we ourselves spend time in the Asura realm. We can certainly see plenty of people in our society who do spend time in the Asura realm. Our society is kind of colored largely by an Asura attitude. This isn't enough, and competitiveness, and winners and losers. Your success is my loss, and vice versa. You know, again, when we're fairly blessed, we're fairly happy, but it's not enough, and we're envious of other people, or we're worried that somebody's going to come take our stuff. And then we can practice gratitude for what we have. Metta practice is probably a good practice for this realm, starting to see ourselves as, you know, interconnected with other beings, not just in competition with them. Non-attachment. And also in a deeper sense, like a real security, because the, you know, Asuras are, they're, you know, if you look at this all in terms of like how you look out for yourself, if you're looking out for yourself by trying to get more and get more territory and get more power and whatever, you know, that reveals a insecurity inside, that if we can solve that in a more lasting and spiritual way, then we won't be so driven to the Asura activities. Any questions or thoughts about heaven or Asuras before I move on?
Which heaven does Mara live in?
Mara, I'm not sure if he lives in. I think Mara is a deva, and he is in the heaven realm. And the reason that he fought so hard against the Buddha, because he didn't want people to leave the desire realm. So even in heaven, you're still in the desire realm. Now, the Buddha was finding a way to step off of this whole wheel entirely. So Mara wants to see us all stay here. Then there's the beast realm. It's also often called the animal realm, but I really like animals, and I think it's kind of insulting to see them all this way. So I call it the beast realm. And this, in this realm, there's beings, there's a willful ignorance, self-absorption, subservience to instinctual and sensual desires and impulses. Food, water, shelter, safety, mating. And just the beings here just pretty much ignore anything else. Other beings, circumstances, repercussions. And moving, you know, toward objects of desire, away from objects of aversion. And it's not that the beings here are stupid. They can be quite clever trying to get what it is that they want, but it's a very limited application of that cleverness. Generally, a little empathy for others, little self-consciousness, or ability to reflect on their own behavior. Compassion, generosity, empathy, etc. are kind of irrelevant. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Deceit, aggression, violence, stealing, hoarding, killing, you know, whatever's necessary. There's limited options, you know, fight, flight, or passivity. Kind of that really basic instinctual responses are all you have available. And there's a single-mindedness, not due to mindfulness, but to obsessive self-concern. And we're reborn here when we've acted as if there are no moral laws in the universe. Acting without concern for consequences or shame. And the Buddha of this realm holds a book of scriptures. So the way out of this realm is to understand karma, to understand cause and effect, and you know the consequences of things that you do and ones that are positive and negative, the benefits of self-discipline, the importance of ethical conduct. And when we're practicing with this realm, this is a very difficult realm to get out of. I think depression can lead us here, life trauma, just difficult circumstances can make it more likely that people end up here. And that's really all they're concerned about is those just immediate, sensual, physical, basic needs. Yeah.
So are you a person here or are you an animal here?
I guess you're an animal. But yeah. But I mean, in the sense that is a metaphor.
Yeah.
People can be living kind of in an animal realm of sorts. So when I don't know. I don't think I've spent too many periods of my life in this realm. I think there was a summer between years of college. That was pretty like, yeah. Delivered pizzas, came home, watched my friends play video games. You know, that was, that would have been the closest that I came. When we're in that place, you know, it's like, it can be difficult, but we need to arouse ourselves out of this limited realm of experience. You know, what else is there? What else can I do? Start paying attention to other people. Some concern for other people. Getting ourselves out of our rut. And waking up and honing and using abilities or sensitivities that kind of let go fallow. Any thoughts about the beast realm before we move on to hell?
I know some animals that I don't picture in that realm.
That's why I call it the beast realm.
Yeah.
Because I think animals can be much more sensitive and, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
And I just can't imagine how you get out of that, but.
Hmm. But yeah, well, that's kind of the whole idea, is that in every realm, there's a possibility. Every realm, there's a possibility of, you know, waking up and making a change. So in the hell realm, so of all the realms, not surprisingly, hell is probably the most described. It has eight. Like I said, there's Yama deciding what. I mean, he doesn't. He just holds the mirror that decides what realm you go to. There are 18 hells, 8 hot, 8 cold, surrounding hells, and ephemeral hells. So in the hot hells, there's everything is heat. The air is filled with flames. It's the kind of place where people are, they're cut up into pieces, and then their body like reassembles, and then they get cut up again, and you know, you're crushed by a big rock, and then your body reassembles itself, and then you're crushed again. And then there's cold hells, where there's no warmth anywhere, and your skin breaks open and sores. So they're named by like the what beings say in pain based on the sores in their skin. And there's no escape. And a lot of times they're kind of, you know, your punishment is kind of poetic, like murderers are tied to each other and they kill each other and then they're revived and that happens again. The surrounding hells, kind of like a cruel joke, it appears like there might be some respite or escape, but then there never is. So it's like, yeah, we're out of, oh no, like the armed guards appear. And so that's the kind of this cruel joke. And then ephemeral hells are custom made for the beings who inhabit them. So, you know, there's people who are trapped in stones. There's a whole bunch of monks that were at a monastery, but they would fight all the time. So they like, their hell is like, they're in this monastery and things are peaceful in the morning, but then over lunch, they, you know, they erupt into this, you know, terrible fight again. And we're reborn here when we, and this is really interesting and critical. So we're reborn here when we allow ourselves to be overcome with anger and hatred and directed aggression. So it's not just that anger and hatred and aggression, we feel it, or even that sometimes we end up acting it out, but this is like we have said yes to this. We have turned down that road. We have given ourselves over to that anger and hatred. So we're way too preoccupied to concentrate on spiritual practice. It's just a hell realm. We acted out our hatred physically, verbally, through deception, through action. And the Buddha of this realm carries two things, a vial of water, representing the cooling effect of patience and forgiveness, and a flame, the fire of practice that purifies karma. So one of the places that this booklet has been very popular is Dharma Rain's prison program. So they find this very helpful for these different states going through, and this idea that really, you know, our hell realm, like we, whatever realm we're in, we're there in a way by choice, based on what we've chosen to do and concentrate on and reinforce in our life. We have doomed ourselves to that particular hell or particular realm. And in the hell realm, you know, is as I think we all are familiar with that sense, when we're overcome with rage and hatred and resentment and whatever, that is everything, and it's painful and awful, and we hold onto it anyway as if we're going to hurt those who have hurt us. But really the way out of it is that is letting go of that. It's forgiveness. It's moving beyond. Once we recognize that that is the way to ease and peace, and our anger and hatred isn't going to change things or hurt those who have hurt us anyway. So, again, metta practice, a sense of non-separation, a sense of self-acceptance. It's probably something that's relevant for all of these realms. But at a certain sense, it's perhaps to some extent, the hell realm is seen as the hardest to get out of, because it can be so hard to let go of those fixed ideas and those resentments, that it just does not seem rational. It just does not seem right. Just no, like you cannot possibly. How do you do that? If you're furious and outraged, how do you just not be? But through practice, we find our way to that freedom. We find our way to that place where we can actually maybe not drop some giant sense of resentment in a second, but we can start letting go of those things. Hell realm reflections.
Different from the Buddha of the Hell Realm, or are they the same character?
No, he's different because he's a bodhisattva that descends into the Hell Realm. He doesn't like belong in, you know, he's not in the Hell Realm technically, I guess. He can leave, I don't know. But he goes down there, and then I don't know, in the imagery I know, he chains himself to a rock so he can't leave until all beings there are liberated. And he has a rope to bind delusions and a sword to cut through them. So. Yeah.
Maybe you already talked about this and I just missed it, but I see a little guy on a ladder and I don't know whether he's climbing out or climbing in.
I think my sense is he's climbing out after having... He just died, and he just visited Yama and looked in the mirror and found out what realm he's going to. So then it's like after having visited Yama, it goes around, whee! Like you get spit off into whatever realm your karma has led you to.
Like a roulette wheel?
Yeah, but it's not random. Like, you know, you're... Yeah. Like it's, you know, once you look in that mirror, it's clear which realm you're headed to, and then off you go.
Looked just below and slightly to the left of the little guy on the ladder. It looks like a guy who might be getting close to trying to get out. I mean, his hands are in dasha, but somebody's trying to pull him back.
Oh, look at that. Huh. Now there's somebody stuck on a cactus or something. Mm-hmm. Being eaten by dogs. Somebody's being devoured by a snake.
I now picture the surrounding hells as being like Pac-Man. And run from the ghost, there's an exit, pop into the other side.
No, I'm right back where I started. All right, so then we get to the hungry ghost realm, which we have a ceremony each year that focuses on this realm. So the pretas of the hungry ghosts are consumed with hunger or thirst. So there are three different kinds of pretas: those with external obstacles, those with internal obstacles, and those with specific obstacles. And that's why I love describing like the imagery, because there's a way that, you know, I could explain, okay, well, the hungry ghost, like, state of mind is like this, and then there's some people, but there's something about the imagery that it conveys something that you really can't convey in another way. So those with external obstacles, do they never find any food or drink? Or when they get there, they're too weak to eat it or drink it. Or by the time they reach it, you know, somebody will say, yeah, there's some food over there, and they get there, and then it's like withered away or rotted or something. Or it's protected by armed men. So they're constantly searching for it, and they just can never get it. The internal obstacles, the pratas with the internal obstacles, so these are the ones with the like giant bellies, thin, tiny necks. They say like their necks are like a blade of grass, and tiny mouths with no bigger than the circumference of a needle. So they can never get, they might get to the food, but they can't get it in. So however much they can get through their tiny mouth, like it's evaporated by the time it gets down their throat. Very, very vivid imagery. And then the specific obstacles, some pretas have specific obstacles, and those are the specialized, like custom-made suffering based on how somebody was stingy or something like that in their life. So we're reborn here because of stinginess, selfishness, and greed. Now, but the greed, you know, there's greed in the Asura realm, but this is a little different. So the greed here is more, I don't know, it's more conscious and feverish, and it's and sensual in a way. It has more to do with like your own, I don't know, your own condition, your own happiness, as opposed to kind of, you know, power and belongings and stuff. There's a way the Asuras are like fine with who they are. They're just a little like caught up in the competitiveness and stuff like that, where the hungry ghost is like, you know, what they're seeking for is a inner nourishment, but they're seeking for it externally. There's, you know, so the food and drink stands for like looking to fill this spiritual void, which actually can never be filled by anything from the outside. And they have a worldview based on lack. And then they're very self-centered and angst-ridden and passionate. And so in a way that's similar to the animal realm, and it's that kind of self-focused, but the hungry ghosts have a little more of a, I don't know, a little more of an existential angst or something going on. So you kind of picture them like pulling on other's sleeves, begging and pleading, or turning again and again to something that once satisfied but hasn't in a long time. So in terms of how this manifests in our world or in our lives, I mean, this can be kind of depression, anxiety, addiction. Addiction is a real, you know, addiction to all kinds of different things, right? We're seeking for some kind of satisfaction in something that's never going to provide it, so, which is then we just kind of keep on wandering around seeking for that.
What are those flames?
Oh, that's where, you know, it looks like there's some great water that you can drink, but once you get there, it turns into flames. And so that's the one that he's trying to go drink the water, and the water turns into flames. The other one, like he's drunk the water, and it's like it's evaporating out of his mouth or turning into flames. And the Buddha there carries a container filled with celestial nourishment, you know, kind of what really will satisfy, and teaches the virtue of generosity and sacrifice. So it's often stinginess that gets us here, and then, and I don't know, I mean, I've definitely spent time in the hungry ghost realm. For me, that has been like, periods of my life where it was like, why doesn't anybody love me? Why doesn't anybody, nobody cares where I am. Nobody calls me. Nobody, you know, I'm all like, I'm just, you know, like my teacher would say, it's like, I'm just going to go in the garden and eat worms. And just this sense of kind of lack and hopelessness and bleakness. But I found that the way to get myself out of that was to look around and see if there's something nice I could do for somebody else. It's like, well, you're probably not the only lonely one. Look around. Maybe there's some other lonely person you could call. And suddenly that shift away from like the self lack to others, suddenly, you know, we're in a world with generosity in it. We're in a world with connection in it. So, once again, there's a way out of it. Now, then in the human realm, in a way it's kind of a letdown, iconography and mythologically, because, well, we're familiar with the human realm. In comparison, it's a mixed bag. There's suffering and there's joy and there's comfort and there's discomfort, and it's almost like all elements of all the other realms are there, but what defines the human realm is constant change, impermanence. It's constantly changing. Birth, old age, illness, and death are going to happen to us. We're going to be separated from what we love, be exposed to what we don't. We have to guard our possessions. So there's a kind of an existential angst because of all the impermanence, and we're seeking for some kind of answer or refuge or identity or something. And we flit about from thing to thing, never quite sure what to do next. So the Buddha in our realm holds the begging bowl, symbolizing spiritual practice and renunciation. So, you know, we're familiar with our practice, right? How do we transcend the human realm? It's to appreciate, and essentially to accept, recognize and accept impermanence. Yes, it's going to be constantly changing. Therefore, we need to not be seeking for permanent refuge in any of this, to find another way to be. And I think for me, just looking over all of the realms, you know, this has been helpful for me at times, recognizing what, because for some reason, like mind states, it even goes beyond that, states of being in a way, body, mind, emotions, everything. There's like, it's always changing, but there are these like kind of coherent states we get in, kind of identifiable states that kind of hang together. Once the jealousy or envy arises, then there's, you know, all that kind of Asura stuff happens. And once we kind of check out and just, you know, zone out with our own physical needs, then that whole like the beast realm stuff happens. And so it's been helpful for me to notice when I'm starting to slip into a realm, or I've gotten kind of stuck in a realm. But I think this also can be very helpful looking around our world and recognizing what's happening with the people around us. Because not so much to be judgmental, but to maybe have a clue about what somebody needs. So if somebody's, you know, if you're dealing with somebody who's just kind of stuck in that beast realm place, then you know what you might suggest to them. Or you recognize if somebody's in a hell realm that is not really due to their circumstances. It's due to something that they themselves can let go of, and you might be able to help support them in doing that or something like that. So any questions or comments?
Seems like the human realm is actually the heaven realm. It's like the Twilight Zone episode where he wins every time on the slot machine, and then he realizes he's actually in hell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dumb slot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the realm of relative freedom because of that impermanence, ironically. Because we're not just kind of stuck in a, you know, solid state of, you know.
What is the icon on the outer circle in the human realm? Significant?
You mean the circle that goes all the way around the outside? Those are that's a 12-fold chain of dependent origination. So I mean, each one of those ones stands for one of the, you know, ignorance and craving and those other pieces on that becoming, old age, disease, and death.
What's the one at the very bottom?
Yeah, he's got an arrow in his eye.
Oh.
I'm not sure which one that is.
Maybe that's his Kensho. He got an arrow in his eye and suddenly he could see everything.
Has anybody who's been exposed to this teaching before found it at all helpful or informative in life?
I spent some time hanging out in the Hell Realm on our retreat this year. And I remembered enough that I went into Sanzan with Josha, and I said, in the Hell Realm, even the air is fire. How do people in the Hell Realm practice? I agree with our answer, which is, it's very, very difficult.
Yep. It's really good to think about just the implications of this this mythology, you know, that it's very different from our Judeo-Christian one. It, you know, heaven is not where we're seeking to go. We're seeking to awaken right here in this human realm. So in a way, we might even be able to achieve heaven for a while, but then we're just going to lose it. So.
There's something in the tradition, too, about how it's super tragic if a monk tries for enlightenment and misses because he'll land in the heaven realm.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a sense that just like, you know, the Buddha explored what is this koan of human suffering, where, you know, he looked around and he saw, you know, people are doomed to old age, disease, death, loss, whatever, eventually. And are we just doomed to, like, well, we're happy and thrilled, and then, well, we're going to be miserable and devastated, and just, is it just like the whims, the fate of life just dictate how we feel and there's nothing we can do about it? But he found, no, we can practice and not be victims of fate. We can have a peace, a lasting peace and joy and whatever you want to call it, that does not depend on circumstances. And so similarly, when you look at these realms, there's a way out of each of these. Like, these are, in a sense, I mean, in the cosmological sense, people have doomed themselves to these realms based on their past actions. But in a more metaphorical sense, we doom ourselves to these states of being by our own thoughts and actions. And not, again, not to judge people, but to, you know, there's that sense of optimism in a way that no matter how stuck somebody is in a realm, There is a way out.
Well, there's also, I'm getting this sense during this discussion that there's a sense that we've all been there. Mm-hmm. We've all been where you are. And it sort of opens up, in a way, it's teaching me to have more compassion for people who are in the lower half, especially the South and Southwestern. I'm still struggling with the beast realm. I get that it's beast, but you know, come on.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, in past lives, you know, the stories of the Buddha in past lives was an animal, and he did really noble things. So, I guess even the animals can practice, I guess. Yeah, so I like to kind of think like those are just the beasts, and there's animals in all the other realms.
Those are the coyotes.
Well, thank you all.